Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Council prepared to proceed.
Morning. May it please the court, Harding Drain for the non-Elkins directors, appellees. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Thomas J. Hall of Chadburn and Park, who will handle the argument this morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Sherry Fallon, may it please the court, on behalf of the Robert Elkins appellee, plaintiff below appellee. With me today is Paul DeFilippo from the firm of Walmuth, Mayer, and Deutsch, who will be speaking on behalf of Robert Elkins this morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the court.
Good morning.
And may it please the court, this is a contract case in which one of the primary issues on appeal is framed by the court below as being whether, I'm quoting from the opinion at page 10, the creditors committee being authorized by a bankruptcy court to initiate an action that could have been brought by the debtor in possession necessarily brings the action on behalf of the debtor in possession. National Union, as appellant here, respectfully suggests that the vice chancellor's failure to answer that question in the affirmative was clear error, certainly as it relates to pre-petition claims of the corporate entity that goes into bankruptcy for injuries sustained by that corporation and to which any recovery would be paid. Now, we're going to rely on our briefs for all the arguments we've raised on appeal, but this morning I want to focus on three points on that issue primarily. First, I want to set the legal framework by talking about the Lafferty and Cybergenics cases in the Third Circuit and about this court's decision in Tulip, the nature of a derivative action. Having done that, I want to turn to the contemporaneous conduct of the director appellees and the creditors committee before the bankruptcy court, which I think will show and demonstrate they well understood that they were seeking authority to act on behalf of the debtors. And thirdly, I want to dispose of their cases. There is no case, no case that holds in their direction. They use a lot of language, but there's no holding because bankruptcy court has never authorized a creditors committee to do anything other than bring a lawsuit in the name of a debtor in possession who fails to act. And that's precisely what they did do before the bankruptcy court. The Lafferty case in the Third Circuit at page 348 makes clear that the issue of the nature of the right, whether this is a derivative case being brought on behalf of the debtor in possession, is a state law question. And I quote from the Lafferty decision at that page, thus any action to redress injuries to the corporation cannot be maintained by an individual shareholder, but must be brought as a derivative action in the name of the corporation. And that court sorted out whether or not, in that case, this was a derivative action or whether the creditors, even though the creditors were ultimate beneficiaries because the estate would be enlarged.
Well, looked at the nature of the here, it's conceded here, is it not, in the court below ruled that the action is derivative. The question is, on whose behalf was it brought?
And I think the answer to that, Your Honor, is a matter of state law. As Lafferty says, and the Lafferty analysis says, it has to be brought in the name of the corporation who owns the claim.
Well, the bankruptcy court authorized the action to be brought on behalf of the estate. And pursuant to that order, the action was brought on behalf of the estate.
Only
why is that not dispositive?
It's not dispositive, Your Honor, because that language appears even in the Cybergenics case. Bankruptcy colloquialism, it plainly is, because if you read Cybergenics, all due respect, in the opening stanzas of that case, the court also talks about, in general terms, that an action is being brought on behalf of the estate, as all bankruptcy cases are, in order to enlarge the recovery for creditors. That's always true. And if that answered the question, there would never be any derivative case. Anyone could act on behalf of the estate. Cybergenics makes plain, if you follow National Underwriters Insurance Company, what the Supreme Court said, because of the way the code is structured, only the debtor in possession or trustee can act on behalf of the estate, because they are the one in possession of the claims. They are the ones with the fiduciary duties. The now withdrawn panel decision on Cybergenics said that means you can't even do a derivative suit in the name of the debtor in possession. Only with the en banc rehearing did they reinstate what has been the received wisdom since the beginning of the 1900s, that you can do what it is that chancery courts typically allow people to do, and that is to step into the shoes and to assert the rights of the corporation. And that is precisely what happened here. To say on behalf of the estate is in no way inconsistent. Let me direct your honor to...
Well, before you do, the Vice Chancellor Noble said or perhaps held in a footnote that the estate is an entity, is a jural entity separate and apart from the debtor in possession, and cited some authorities. You disagree with that?
I do.
Is that the pivotal issue on this appeal? That is, will that dispose of the appeal?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think that the very footnote that the court, is footnote 27, in which the court says, in effect, that the estate owns the claims, but the Cigna case that is cited says, and that footnote 27 directly the opposite, it says that the claims can only be brought by the debtor in possession. The confusion is over, sure, the estate is in some senses a statutory entity.
My question is that the pivotal issue? That is, if he is right, if we were to agree with him, would that dispose of this appeal? Would that require an affirmance?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so.
Why not?
Because I don't think that whether this is brought on behalf of the state answers the question of whether one, in order to do that, must, as a matter of law, also be acting on behalf of the only entity that has the right under the bankruptcy code to act on behalf of the estate, the debtor in possession. The cases that they cite that appear to go to the contrary are trustee cases. Every case they cite to this court for the proposition that they are acting on behalf of the state is a trustee case. And that's different because the trustee displaces the debtor in possession and asserts a direct right. The IC cases and the receiver cases are all of the same ilk. There is no question about derivative in those cases.
But this policy would allow the trustee, if this had gone through a plan, the trustee brought this very claim, there would be no argument like you're making today.
No question, Your Honor, because the policy says if there's a trustee appointed by the court who displaces the debtor in possession, the exclusion doesn't apply.
All right, so isn't the real issue, I'm trying to sort through the fabric of this policy and see what was at least in somebody's mind when it was written. If the trustee could bring this very same claim that the debtor in possession cannot and have coverage, isn't it all about collusion and the concern about collusion and that there was no such worry with regard to the trustee that there is with regard to the debtor in possession? And isn't that, as a follow-through on that, nobody really foresaw an issue as to a creditors committee, and if they had, the creditors committee would be unlikely to be involved in the same collusion any more than the trustee?
Precisely to the opposite effect, Your Honor, because the nature of bankruptcy practice with the debtor in possession and four of the director appellees constituting the board of directors working hand in hand with a creditors committee who has to deal with them is a problem. And it is this very kind of case where we've had notice of this long after the fact, where we were set up. The only person who can pay any money here is National Union. That was a done deal before we knew about it. By interaction of the creditors committee and the board of directors for the director defendants in the underlying action, that is precisely the issue that is of concern to us. That's precisely the issue that the on behalf of language is meant to deal with. In the bankruptcy court, day in and day out, there is only one situation in which a derivative case is brought by a creditor's committee on behalf of the debtor in possession. That's the received wisdom for many, many decades. That is precisely the reason why the on behalf of is in there. The debtor, and we define the debtor in possession in. The trustee doesn't bring it on behalf of. The trustee brings it in its own right. So to go their way would take the on behalf of language and literally make it meaningless. Literally make it meaningless. This is the very situation it's designed to cover.
But it's not meaningless if, as Vice Chancellor Noble held, the estate is a jural entity distinct from the debtor in possession.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree because I don't think the court did hold that it is a juridical entity in the sense that it could appear and be heard. It held only that it was a distinct legal entity.
Yes.
To which I say is beside the point. It's a distinct legal entity because it not only is pre-petition property, but there's certain bankruptcy rights, but it is still just property. It can't own anything. It is the thing that is owned. Can we give you, Your Honor?
But didn't the court, in effect, say that this distinct jural entity, that is, the estate, does own the property or owns the claim, and therefore an action brought on behalf of the estate as a distinct entity is not an action brought on behalf of the debtor in possession.
And the court erred in that holding, Your Honor.
But the court did hold that.
The court, in effect, said and bought into the error that the court was led into by my opponents that the estate owned the claim. And that is true.
All right.
But let me deal with it. Go ahead, Your Honor. I don't mean to cut the court off for sure.
I'm just trying to, again, ask if that is the pivotal error, the pivotal issue.
That is certainly a pivotal issue, both on the law and on the facts, because there's been a reversal of position by the director of appellees that I want to deal with factually. But on the law, the cases that they cite on that point are cases that are sorting out, for purposes unrelated to the issue here, whether, for example, a debtor who sells its property has sold bankruptcy claims created by statute. And the court said, for example, in Cybergenics 1, no, when you sell your assets, you can't sell bankruptcy claims.
If we have to delve into whether or not Vice Chancellor Noble's holding of that point was correct, aren't we as a state court, in effect, second-guessing a determination of federal law?
No, Your Honor, because that holding is just clearly erroneous. Lafferty said...
Clearly erroneous by what standard?
Because...
By which set of rules?
By this court's standards in Tooley. Lafferty says it's a state law issue as to whether or not they must be acting in the name of the corporation, whether they're bringing this on behalf of the corporation. Lafferty says that's a state law issue. Tooley makes it clear that if the injury is to the company, which I don't think is undisputed, and if the money goes to the company, which is not disputed, that this is a derivative claim on behalf of the corporation. Nothing in the court's order is to the contrary.
So if there's a body of federal law, assume that there is for purposes of this question, that posits that the estate is a separate, distinct entity, the lower court, the Court of Chancery, was supposed to ignore that and simply look to the state law on this issue?
No, Your Honor. The court was supposed to ask, does it make any difference that it's a distinct entity for purposes of the inquiry here? And the answer is it makes no difference for purposes of this inquiry. The estate is a property concept. If the court were to look at Section 1109B of the Bankruptcy Code, which is a long laundry list of parties in interest, entities that can appear and be heard, there is the creditors committee, there are indenture trustees, there are trustees, but there is not an estate. The estate is a property concept. It is not an entity that can appear except via the debtor in possession, and that's the point. If Your Honor would look at page B47 of the appellee's appendix, Director Newhall objected to authority being granted here. In his objection, in the very first line, notwithstanding the motion that tried to draft around this issue, notwithstanding the order, his objection was to authority being granted to bring the claims on behalf of the debtors. They knew and understood that was the way it was done. Notwithstanding the order, they said that. Four of these directors approved the Elkins Agreement, which acknowledges that these claims belong to the debtors, not to the estate. There was nobody was saying they were owned by the estate then.
Is that an estoppel argument, or is that just evidentiary? What's the
argument is not as it is that the answer turns on the law. There's nothing in the order inconsistent with the law. And since the 1900s, the answer has turned on whether or not this was an injury to the corporation, whether the recovery was to the corporation. Cybergenics did nothing more than say, we're going to allow that, but that's what the only way it's been done. There is no case, no case that they can cite where a creditor's committee has brought an action other than standing in the shoes of the debtor. And it's only creditor's committee that get that authority because trustees don't need it. They have the claim they can assert it directly. It is this very situation that is governed by the on behalf of language that was designed to be out. If this court were to sustain the ruling below, it would in effect be allowing the creditor's committee to bring an action asserting rights of the debtor while the debtor is still in possession of those rights. You'd be saying without going through the debtor in possession. The Supreme Court decision in National Underwriters and the Cybergenics decision in Third Circuit says that can't be done. The statutory code does not permit it. They have to stand in the shoes of the debtor in possession. It's that simple. And no amount of leaving out the phrase in the order changes that. Their own actions contemporaneously in the Elkins Agreement, in fact, Your Honor, they made a demand on the debtor in possession. Why? If the debtor in possession had brought this lawsuit, there would be no coverage. They would have no right to bring it. They couldn't act on behalf of the estate because the debtor in possession is the only one who can. You've got to go through the debtor in possession to assert these claims because the debtor in possession, that's the key phrase, is in possession of the claims. No one else is. It's Bright and Derivative Suit.
You're into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use or you could save.
Let me just say one thing about the Elkins loss. The court erred on that issue, I would respectfully suggest, because I think the court maybe just didn't understand the nature of the agreement. The court says at footnote 4 of page 3 of the opinion that Elkins was not exonerated from all liability. He was exonerated from liability exceeding liability under the policies. That is not correct. Elkins has no exposure because the agreement says he's only left liable for that which National Union actually paid. In other words, if National Union were for some reason to go into receivership or just steadfastly refuse to pay, he would never have any exposure. There is no recourse against Elkins. That's been his counsel's position in the underlying action and his position in this case. The court said as much at the oral argument, which is included at page A439 of our appendix. The court said, as far as I can tell, he has no exposure. The court was right about that. And again, that's the very kind of claim that the definition of loss is set up to avoid. The contracts here couldn't be clearer. There's no way in the bankruptcy scheme of things that this claim can be brought except through the debtor in possession. It's their rights that are being asserted. If you look at Lafferty, for example, impari delicto was asserted as a defense and sustained, even though the creditors committee brought that case on behalf of the estate, in the generic sense that the state would benefit. But the court attributed impari delicto to the debtor in possession. And the committee was stuck with that. Why? Because the committee was standing in the shoes of the debtor in possession. It's the only way it can appear before the court. Before you can act on behalf of the estate, you have to act on behalf of the debtor in possession. Under the code is the only one that can do that. The only one that can do that. Unless they're displaced by a trustee.
So if this were reduced to, claim were reduced to a judgment, in whose favor would the judgment be?
Debtor in possession. That's why I would suggest to you that they named the debtor in possession as a party in the bankruptcy court. That's why they made a demand. That's why the order earmarks it for use for creditors, because they weren't going to control it. It was going to go to the debtor in possession. If you look at this as the time of the filing of the claim, which is the right way to do it, this is a garden variety derivative suit that we all know in Delaware, and it turns on Delaware approach to whether it's a derivative suit. They're not going to tell you anything different, Your Honor. The only time it would go anyplace else is under a confirmed plan, which isn't relevant for measuring this. It would be, I respectfully suggest, a disaster for our state to rule when it turns on state law. Is this the kind of claim that has to be brought on behalf of the company? It's no different than any other case we've seen. The Tooley test applies, and it should be reversed. It's flatly inconsistent with National Underwriters and Cybergenics. and the court below was wrong in taking the estate concept, which, sure, it's an entity, but it doesn't answer the question of who are you appearing and asserting the claim on behalf of. In 1109B, the estate is not listed. It's a property concept. It would make no sense to actually put a property concept in the list of juridical entities. Unless the court has questions, I'm going to save a little bit of time.
May it please the court, Thomas Hall, on behalf of the 8 non-Elkins former directors. It is our position, Your Honors, that the policy language here is clear, and the application of the undisputed facts here will lead to the unmistakable conclusion reached by the Vice Chancellor. Those undisputed facts should be, number one, the claims belong to the estate. We think that is unmistakable as a matter of federal law. Number two, the...
In whose name would a judgment be entered?
Today, I think it'd be in the name of the committee on behalf of the estate. It cannot today be in the name of debtor possession. Debtor possession no longer exists as a result of the bankruptcy, of the confirmed plan. So I think it has to be in the name of the entity bringing the suit on behalf of what's left of the estate.
But what about at the time it was filed?
I think it'd be the same. Ultimately, the money's going into the estate, and it's flowing through the plaintiff here, the creditors committee. So I think the judgment would be in the name of the plaintiff here.
Mr. Hall, let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Ashby: is the pivotal issue whether or not the estate is a distinct juridical entity from the debtor in possession?
I think that's a key issue. I think if you find that it is, that I think an affirmance is mandated. If you find that it isn't, I wouldn't give up on our arguments for several reasons. It's clear that the claim here is being brought on behalf of the estate because it's for the benefit of the estate. So even if it is not purely distinct from the debtor in possession, the bankruptcy order is clear. It's for the benefit of the estate, and therefore the claim, regardless of who exactly owns them or whether they truly are distinct entities, because the funds will go into the estate and not the debtor in possession. I would not give up on our argument. But I think the law is clear, Your Honor, that it is very much a distinct legal entity under the bankruptcy code.
And that is critical to your case.
It's important to our case. It is important to our case. But let me, I'll give you, I was going through the Cybergenics decision last night, Mr. Ashby suggests that a creditors committee could only bring a case on behalf of the debtor in possession. That's the only possible way it could happen. I'll just throw out just a few quotes from Cybergenics, where the court ruled that a committee can bring actions on behalf of the estate. On page 561, the Third Circuit says, Collier explains that consistent with the broad right of participation conferred by Section 1109B, the court may authorize a party in interest to commence litigation on behalf of the estate. The court's not saying on behalf of debtor in possession. That's our language and our policy on behalf of. And the Third Circuit here is saying Congress has determined courts may authorize committees to bring litigation on behalf of the estate. That's our position. Page 563, like Section 1109B, however, Section 1103C5 suggests that Congress intended for creditors' committee to perform services on behalf of the estates. Again, the key language, on behalf of. Page 566, Sections 1109B and 1103C5 taken together evince a congressional intent for committees to play a robust and flexible role in representing the bankruptcy estate. Again, I think clear evidence that at least the Third Circuit sees the bankruptcy estate as a separate legal entity. The last one I'll read, page 570 from Cybergenics.
But Cybergenics, the Third Circuit in that case, didn't say that in so many words, did they?
Well, Well, this is the analysis. They're walking through the justification for the result they reach, which is the creditors committee does have standing. And when it walked through the justification, it pointed out numerous positions in the code and elsewhere where it determined the committee could act on behalf of the estate. But no, I don't think Cybergenics expressly said the estate was a separate legal entity. I think that's right. But lastly, Cybergenics on page 570 talks about the pre-bankruptcy act practice of creditors' ability to obtain court permission to pursue actions on behalf of the estate. And I think if you look at the various cases in this area dealing with the insured exclusion, and whether you're dealing with a trustee, and these aren't all trustee cases, and in Alston it was a bankruptcy examiner. In some cases you're dealing with the FDIC. And what the courts look to really in making this determination as to whether they really were acting on behalf of the corporation are several things. One is, as Judge Jacobs, you asked the right question, whether the entity bringing it is a distinct legal entity, whether it's independent of the debtor in possession, whether it's managed by the debtor in possession, and whether it owes duties to debtor in possession. Here, the committee satisfies all of those factors. The committee is a separate legal entity. The committee is independent of the debtor in possession. The debtor in possession, which some of my clients were directors of during bankruptcy, but it does not control the committee. And the committee owes its fiduciary duties to the creditors, not to the debtor in possession. And if there's any doubt as you go through this analysis as to, could this be on behalf of the estate, could the claim be on behalf of the debtor in possession, there are several principles of Delaware law that I think make the result here clear. And those include that the carrier here has the burden of proving the exclusion applies. And secondly, the policy is to be construed against the carrier, particularly when it comes to an exclusion. I think Vice Chancellor Noble phrased the question properly when he said it's whether the committee necessarily brings the action on behalf of the debtor in possession. National Union, in its brief, concedes several times that the committee here, and they use the phrase, in some sense, but they concede that at least in some sense, the committee brings its action on behalf of the estates. And they point to the fact that the proceeds will go to the estates and that type of thing.
Yeah, but the sense in which they're conceding that is that the phrase on behalf of the estate is merely a figure of speech. It has no legal significance. It may have poetic significance, but that under Delaware law, which they argue is controlling, a derivative action is necessarily brought on behalf of the debtor in possession. Which, if that is the case, I assume would then fall squarely under the insured versus insured exclusion.
Well, I think the Vice Chancellor hit that on the head when he discussed the derivative structure in the bankruptcy context and who was serving what role, and he suggested, I think correctly, that the debtor in possession doesn't own these claims. The debtor in possession is more like the board of directors of a corporation and decides whether to bring them or not. And should the board of directors fail to bring the claim, then in the classic derivative case, shareholders can. In our case, the court allowed the creditors committee to bring it when the debtor in possession failed to. But when you look at who the claim is on behalf of, whether in the corporate derivative context or the bankruptcy context, it's the entity that owns the claim, whether it's the corporation pre-bankruptcy or the estate post-bankruptcy, and the entity that's going to receive the benefit of the claim. Again, corporation pre-bankruptcy and estate post-bankruptcy. So I think when you look at it from a derivative perspective, I think Vice Chancellor had it right. The other legal principle I think that is useful here, and it's related, but that there is an obligation on an insurer to make sure its policy is clear. And I was bemused a couple days ago when I saw on the cover of this policy that it's the National Union D&O Gold policy. I hate to think where we'd be if we just had the silver policy, but we bought the gold policy. But the litigation, if you go back and look at the litigation on insured v. insured and what it means, this litigation's been going on for 18 years. There are at least 15 published decisions addressing National Union's insured v. insured exclusion, going back some 14 years. All they had to do here is add two words to the definition where they defined company in the event of bankruptcy as meaning debtor in possession. If they added the words or estate, we wouldn't be here. And it was their obligation, if that's how they construe this, to include those words if they meant to apply to this type of situation. I take issue with Mr. Ashby's statement that the only entity who can pay any money here is National Union. That's not true. I've got eight clients here, four of whom were directors of this company pre-bankruptcy, four of whom were directors during bankruptcy, none of whom are any longer directors because the company's been dissolved. For the most part, they were outside disinterested directors. For the most part, I think all but one received some of this compensation, but seven of them received none of the compensation that's at issue in the creditors committee action. They have no releases. They face personal liability. Their indemnification rights against the company are worthless because the company has no money. We're looking at a claim. We had some of the claims dismissed, but we're looking at a claim that we value at about $50 to $60 million, the creditors committee claim. We don't think there's any merit to it, but that's what they're facing. And their life savings are exposed. Without coverage here, these eight individuals, and I'm not talking about Mr. Elkins, but these eight individuals face personal liability. I think Judge McKelvey had it right in the Allspring decision. When he was deciding whether to apply an insured v. insured, he looked to see whether the case, and there it was brought in the bankruptcy context by a bankruptcy examiner, not by a creditors committee, but he said the insured v. insured is not intended to apply to an adversarial situation. Okay, if the debtor in possession here, as managed by my clients, was bringing this case, one could argue it's not adversarial, but when an independent creditors committee brings the action and fights as hard as it has been fighting, we've been in this litigation with the creditors committee for 3 years, and it's not over yet, it's clearly adversarial, and I'll note that that action is pending before Vice Chancellor Noble. He knows how hard we've been fighting it, and we've been fighting that hard because we have eight clients facing $50 million in personal liability. Thank you.
Baldy Filippo for defendant plaintiff here, Robert Elkins. I want to first answer Justice Jacobs' question whether the estate is a distinct legal entity, because I think the answer is clearly yes. And the reason it's yes is because that when the debtor in possession, which is in the initial stages of the Chapter 11, the representative of the estate, when the debtor in possession is replaced by a trustee, which often happens, the debtor in possession ceases to exist. However, the estate does not cease to exist at that point. The estate remains in existence and simply changes representatives from the debtor in possession to the trustee. That should answer the question whether the estate is a distinct legal entity, without doubt, because how could it cease to exist if the debtor in possession passed out of existence and the estate continues? Next, I'd like to just briefly touch on why the security holder exclusion in the policy does not apply, and that is simply because, based on the plain language of the policy, the creditors committee is not a security holder of the debtor IHS. It is not even made up of a majority of security holders. The creditors committee, the nine-member committee, was made up of four holders of bank debt, two trade creditors, and three bondholders. Bank debt and trade creditors are not security holders under the Securities Act of the United States. So this committee was not even made up of a majority of security holders, but even more importantly, under the plain language of the policy, the committee does not hold any securities of this debtor, so could not be a security holder within the meaning of the exclusion. The central issue I would like to address is the loss issue. And although the order appealed from only on its face ruled on the applicability of the insured versus insured exclusion, the lower court did rule in its opinion that Dr. Elkins was susceptible of suffering a loss within the language of the policy. It's our position that finding was correct and should not be disturbed. The policy obligates the insurer to pay the loss of an insured, and loss is defined as damages, judgments, settlements, and defense costs. Loss does not include any amount for which the insured is not financially liable or which is without legal recourse to the insured. That's the exact language of the exclusion. None of the terms financially liable or without legal recourse are defined in the policy, and therefore the court must construe those words in a manner which is favorable to the insured and adverse to the insurer. In the Elkins agreement, the scope of released claims excludes a loss arising from wrongful acts as those terms are defined in this policy, but only up to the amounts paid under the policy. Anything over that is released. Elkins is being sued by the committee on behalf of the estates for wrongful acts as defined in the policy. If a judgment is entered against him, it will constitute a loss as defined by the policy. However, the sole source of recovery for that judgment is any amounts payable by the carrier. In support of its argument, the carrier cites two cases. The New York case is not applicable because in that case...
And your client has a duty to cooperate with National Union in defense of that, even though he may not have a personal stake in the outcome?
Yes.
Otherwise, he'll lose his coverage.
And right. we are defending ourselves vigorously in that action, notwithstanding their denial of coverage. The two cases that the carrier relies on, the New York case, McDonough, is inapplicable because in that case the insurer received a complete release from all liability. The Georgia case is not applicable because that case is one of a series of cases in a number of states which address the issue of whether or not an insurer should be exonerated from liability if its insured is not legally obligated to pay the judgment against it. And in a later Georgia case called Dowse versus Southern Guarantee, affirmed by the Supreme Court, that court held that notwithstanding an agreement between a plaintiff and an insured, whereby the plaintiff agrees not to execute on the assets of the insured, but only to seek recovery from the insured insurance policy, there is no exclusion from coverage based on the absence of a loss, or in other words, that the insured is not legally obligated to pay. The only way, and the Georgia case is careful to note, the only way the insurance company is relieved from liability is if the settlement between the plaintiff and the insured is unreasonable and collusive. The cases that have decided this in Nebraska, Pennsylvania, Arizona, New Jersey, Iowa, Indiana, and Florida all have found that there is coverage unless the underlying settlement is collusive and unreasonable. Now, here, there's no reason to address the underlying settlement because there has not been one. We're not here arguing about whether the committee and Elkins entered into an agreement where we gave the committee a judgment for $50 million, and now they're seeking recovery from the insurance company. That's not before the court, and that has not happened. So it takes the case out of the rule of the Georgia case that the insurance company cites. Instead, Your Honors, if the insurance company would discharge its obligation to provide a defense and to indemnify my client, it could protect itself completely from the risk of being subject to the collusive and unreasonable settlements between the plaintiff and the insurer, which are the subject of the cases that I referred to. Unless Your Honors have any questions, I see my time is almost up.
And how would it protect itself?
It could defend and decide whether to settle on its own. Thank you.
Counsel, one quick question. You started out by arguing that the estate is a distinct legal entity. Is that a critical argument for your case? So suppose we find that it's not. Does it matter?
I think there are other reasons that the court could affirm, but that seemed to be a very important part of the Vice Chancellor's reasoning.
I want to come back to the question on the court's mind about the entity being distinct. Does that answer the question? I suggest that it's the beginning of the analysis. The next question is it an entity that has a right to sue? The debtor in possession can sue on behalf of the estate. A trustee, and I suggest to you that in Alstrin case, it was a similar situation where there was a trustee or an examiner that displaced the debtor in possession. In those situations, that entity has a right to sue. Conceded here that the creditors committee has a right to sue on behalf of the state, but only derivatively. What significance do we give to that? The nature of the claim is one that says that they can only derive the right to sue from the entity that owns the right to sue. That's the debtor in possession. Cybergenics makes that clear. Cybergenics.
What else? They get the right to sue from the federal statutes and the court order?
No, Your Honor, because under the federal statute, the debtor in possession is the only one who has a right to do that. That's clear under Cybergenics. And Cybergenics has all of the language that was read to you, but it also has this language, and this is the holding. Quote at page 553, our conclusion is consistent with the received wisdom that nearly all courts considering the issue have permitted creditors committee to bring actions in the name of the debtor in possession. If the committee can establish that a debtor is neglecting its duty, it's the right to sue. They must necessarily act first on behalf of the debtor in possession, because under the statutory scheme, it is only the debtor in possession who has the right to enforce the claims. If we do not win, then what is the meaning of the fact that their right is derivative? It would be the same as everybody else's. That's not clear. Cybergenics says no. They have to sue in the name of the company. And
did
that
anybody ask the federal court to clarify that?
Your Honor, I don't think that there was any need for the court to do that. If you look at the contemporaneous, and this is listed in our, at the contemporaneous actions of the committee and the directors, the Elkins agreement recites that these claims belong to the debtor. The debtor is the one that negotiated Mr. Elkins' release. The motion for approval recited that they belong to the debtor. The order, amended order approving the Elkins agreement, recited that. They made a demand on the debtor in possession. Mr. Newhall, who objected, wasn't confused. B-47 of his own objection. He knew they were seeking authority to sue on behalf of the debtors. There was no confusion and no need to ask. And Lafferty sends us back and saying, it's state law. Was the company injured by these claims? Would the company recover? That really is the end of the question, because they must be standing in the shoes of that debtor. It's absolutely that clear. Any other result flies in the face of federal law. You're allowing something to happen that Cybergenics says can't happen, except by standing in the shoes of the debtor. One last point.
I'm sorry, your time's up.
That'd be one last point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We appreciate the arguments, and we'll stand in a brief recess.
Please rise.